Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. This week, my guest is Steve Phillips. Steve is the author of two bestsellers. His first book was Brown is the New White, and the new one, How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. A true Renaissance man, Steve was a civil rights lawyer, political activist, columnist, and also is the founder of Democracy in Color, the organization and podcast. Oof, talk about energy. Okay, let's dive in. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Where are you? Are you in California?
Yeah, I'm in San Francisco dealing with the downpour.
Is that like an attic, Finnish attic, attic area?
Yes, this is the attic in my house.
Is this where you do the podcast also?
It is not actually. I mean, sometimes I have a podcast studio in my basement that is more, even more soundproofed. I've got like the stuff on the walls and the ceiling and the soundproofing and whatnot. And the, what do you call it? The movers, rugs or whatnot.
Wow.
So I kind of go back and forth between here and there, depending.
I found out about you through my friend Spencer Overton. I've known him mm-hmm. since law school. We both grew up in the Detroit area. How do you know Spencer?
Well, it's so funny you're saying this. Like, Spencer's from Detroit. I just kind of know Spencer from the movement.
I mean, we met in law school. I didn't know him in Michigan, though, but we were, you know.
Yeah, no, I know him more through, like, D.C. politics, social change stuff. Just kind of over the past, I don't know, decade or so, something like that. So, but it's one of those people's like, where did we actually meet? But it's been in that D.C. social change milieu.
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly a big part of that. I think he mentioned you because he knew I was launching this podcast and with, you know, I'm interested in the work he does with the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. I just saw he did a review of your new book that we're talking about today.
Yeah, he did. That was very generous of him. So.
Yeah. I also want to say that I'm really sorry for your loss. I know of Susan, that she is a very remarkable person. It's hard for me to use the past tense. And you did dedicate your new book, How We Win the Civil War, to her. Is it okay if I read that dedication to
yes.
you? The reality of cancer forces one to a more spiritual place of contemplating life, meaning, and legacy. That reflection has fueled my work on this book to try to make it a lasting legacy for both of us. You worked together, have known her for more than 30 years. How did you meet and what was that relationship like?
Well, since I went through the, I did clean out our basement. I had like stuff there from when we moved into this house in 2006, we just put in the basement that like eventually we'll get to it. And of course, mm-hmm. never got to it. And I came across this document. So there's a fairly, whatever, famous story in our little family about how we almost met in college, but it was good that we didn't at that time. And so this was in the mid-80s. I was chairman of the Black Student Union, very involved in the Free South African movement.
And this is in college at Stanford?
This was in college at Stanford in the mid-1980s. And then Susan was involved in like consensus decision making with largely right. So a lot of white lefty progressive types. And it actually turns out that one of my good friends, actually Stacey Layton, because you're in the law. Stacey was a Supreme Court clerk back in the day at Stanford Law School. For whatever reason, she thought that Susan and the kind of like Susan's crowd should come teach us how to do decision making. And so so you're going to have this, you know, white grouping of folks. And Susan, she'd done like butcher paper and put stuff together and whatnot. But I don't know if the word just didn't get to us or what, but we didn't show up. And we all agree it was best that we did not, in terms of that would not have been an auspicious beginning.
Yeah.
But no, we met at an education reform conference. I mean, actually, because it is, you know, tied together in terms of the arc of the story. So my first job out of, when I left college, was in at a school reform project in San Francisco, working with public interest law firm, public advocates, called the Collaboration for Educational Excellence. And so Susan's family helped to fund that. And the program officer, Sylvia Yee, she says, oh, Susan Sanders says she knows you. You were at Stanford together. Because I had the, you know, higher profile in the Free South Africa movement or whatever. And so I started asking around about her. One of my good friends from college, Lisa Neely, is like, oh, I went to high school with her. She studies a lot, was one of the first things that she had said. And then we went to the school reform conference at University of San Francisco. That's where we met. I think we were each on each other's radar because I was running, I was working on this project, and that she, you know, her family had, had funded it. I had heard of her. And I mean, it's just also kind of funny and crazy. So it's like we're sitting next to each other at this conference about school reform in California. And I like lean over to her and said, well, this is all fine, but how are we going to change the whole state of California? So I think that was like a great line in terms of capturing her attention and interest. And so we kind of set out from there on a journey to do social change, education reform originally, and then on the broader political change. So,
if you had met, I mean, if you, at that time, it seems like, I'm just guessing that you both were coming at a similar problem in different ways. We might have been in college at the same time, and that was when my friends who were part of the divestment movement, I was at Yale. They were trying to, you know, there were huge protests on Beinecke Plaza. I have friends who were arrested for sit-ins and expelled from school. I don't think they were looking at, you know, sort of non-confrontational politics at the time. Is that what you're getting at? Is it, that it wouldn't have been the best way to meet if you had met then?
Or? Yes, very much. We were, I mean, it was, you know, people were marching through the streets in South Africa facing being shot down. And it was a very intense period and a very intense struggle. And so it was really more about building power, fighting back, withstanding these attacks was what was top of mind, more so than consensus decision-making.
It's interesting because I did not know your connection with her, and just thinking about it, how much her family has supported some of the organizations where many of my friends have worked or where I have gone to events. I have a good friend from law school who is now in the cabinet, and she worked for the Center for Responsible Lending. I wrote a book on the savings and loan, well, the connection between the savings and loan debacle in the 2008 financial crisis and toxic mortgages. And obviously with that, and of course, ProPublica is an incredible organization.
Yeah, and then you had Joe Nocera on your podcast.
Oh, yes, right? I adore Joe.
Yeah, and so he wrote a very big piece on Susan's parents in, I think it was 2006.
Probably when he was a Times columnist.
Yes, he was at the Times around, you know, the credible track record that they had had. And then, you know, if you worked on the savings and loan in the industry, what got lost in all of the craziness is that a loan among all the institutions, they held on to their loans. Yeah. They were not making bad loans and selling them off to
people. They were not doing originate to distribute, right?
Right. No, they made good loans and held on to them. And that was an extraordinary business for them. And then they created the Center for Responsible Lending because they were really very passionate about ethics and business. And so that, you know, translated over to their philanthropy. And then, you know, Susan kind of inherited that philanthropy tradition. I shouldn't even say that. Susan actually started them on the philanthropic tradition.
Oh,
and so in
like the young
80s,
kids saying, "Hey, get involved." Oh, interesting. Yes. Oh, tell me this. Oh,
exactly. Okay. So she was in the late 80s. She was saying, "Shouldn't we be doing something in philanthropy?" And that got the family conversations started, and they started interviewing different potential staff people, looking at different program areas, and so she was the impetus for that. So that's, you know, I think the is a relevant part of the story. And, you know, I mean, I've been kind of you know, anybody who knows me would not be surprised, you know, utilizing Facebook as my, like, platform of choice. When I turned 50, Susan organized a secret Facebook group for people to post on Facebook, which was the, it was the perfect balance of, you know, not overwhelming, but being connected to people, et cetera. And so I've been kind of having this rolling memorial on Facebook about Susan. And it said something about how we had, what we had was a love story for the ages. Mm. We transcended barriers of race, religion, and class to find each other, forge a life together, and set about trying to change the world. And I think that's very true. She brought me into that world, helped to empower me and understand it, and then tried to put those resources to the cause that, you know, poverty, economic justice, racial justice, that, you know, we both cared passionately about.
I know you probably know from the Jewish tradition, there's an expression, may her memory be for a blessing.
Mm.
And I know that you are living your, you know, through her, and your work continues. And speaking of your work, your recent book, How We Win the Civil War, I want to talk about the subject matter, but I really fell in love with you. I not fell in love, but with your mind, with your writing, because you bring a sense of humor to this and humanity. And you're very thoughtful about the reader's experience. And so I want to point out one of these things that you wrote that I found that made me laugh out loud, because the subject matter is urgent and serious, but right. It's been urgent and serious for hundreds of years. And if we can't laugh along the way, what are we doing here? And so you were reminding us about the Paul Revere riding through Massachusetts towns on horseback. And we've all heard, you know, I don't know if he actually said this, but we always supposedly he said, the British are coming, you know, trying to warn people of the you know, impending invasion. And then you write, imagine if Revere had instead ambled down the street saying, we're going to invite the British to dinner and see if we can reach a bipartisan agreement. Cinema and Manchin are bringing the clam chowder. And to me, that encapsulates, you know, that could, you know, that cut, to me, that's like channeling MLK from Letter from Birmingham Jail. This is like the white moderate, like, not getting it. And then you sort of made this comment saying, I'm not trying to be flip. Okay, maybe I am. Do you find that when you're writing about this, you're just cracking yourself up with jokes all the time? Or why do you decide to include these asides? Because I enjoy them.
I don't know if it's all the time, but I think that the, you know, Charlene Chang was my book editor, or on both of my books, had made this point about trying to put more of myself into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did want it to be very accessible. And that's also something that Susan had really impressed upon me, is the importance of stories and really trying to use stories that this material could be accessible. So that, I think that's part of it. But also for one, it was helpful to be able to take the historical sweep.
Right.
Really looking from the Civil War all the way up to now, and then to really understand and have more confidence. And so I thought there was a kind of a subliminal dimension to it in terms
sure.
of, I think that progressive people in general, people talking about, you know, racial justice in particular, are categorized as being angry. And there's a subliminal dimension to that, is that you're angry because you're disempowered. But if you are actually feeling more powerful, you can kind of laugh at the absurdity of what other people are suggesting and what strategies and things that they're talking about, because they're so detached from the grounding in the historical reality. So that, I think, was a conscious and intentional dimension, because it's to give the emotion of confidence that we are right, this analysis is correct, and we can actually mock people who have this other approach and do so secure in the knowledge that the facts back us up.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. It's funny you should say that the ability to laugh shows that you have more power than when you're angry. There's this line that sticks with me from one of my English literature classes from college, and it was that irony is the discourse of the disempowered. But I suppose anger is even one step lower on the ladder of power. That makes a lot of sense.
Now, there's a line from one of Mao Zedong's books refers to the evolution of movements and the communities. He refers to the machine smashing phase. And that has always struck with me because that's an early but relatively unsophisticated but understandable phase of you're just lashing out and you're just going to do machine smashing. Mm. And then you kind of evolve from there to how you really get and wield power.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing I appreciated, again, before we even get to the argument, the polemic in this book, is the author's note that begins the book. And it shows that, you know, you kind of want to, you don't want people wondering why you made certain choices. So you set out and explain them. And there are two. The first relates to using names. And the second relates to a punctuation issue. So the first thing is you note that you're going to use people's full names, their first name and their surname, but that if you know them well, the second time around, you'll call them by their first name. Can you tell me a little bit more about that decision and why you felt it was important to explain your choice there?
Because there's historically been and actually I think you mentioned Martin Luther King, and you even mentioned this letter from a Birmingham jail. He has this line in there, which also makes me think about so interesting the things that shape you when you're growing up. Mm. So when I was in elementary school, I read Letter from Birmingham Jail.
You were
young. There was a
passage.
I must have been an odd kid. There was a passage that I wrote out by hand and put into a plastic bag and sealed it.
Oh, my God.
And so there is this, and it's like a sentence that is almost a whole paragraph long, where he talks about, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. And he goes mm-hmm. through this whole litany, really, of indignities and abuses. And one of the things he mentions is, I forget the exact wording, but it's like when your first name is John and your middle name is Boy, regardless what your name is. So names have always been very important and as a form of disrespect, particularly mm-hmm. to people of color, particularly to women of color. And there's also been a piece around people, working very hard for their titles and for the respect that comes with the name. And so people have historically used the first names of people as a way of disrespecting them.
Yeah.
Well, this is the that line stuck with me for whatever, 50 years, Sidney Poitier, and In the Heat of the Night. It mm-hmm. says, what do they call you up there? Virgil, and he says, they call me Mr. Tibbs. And that's resonated with me for decades. And so I wanted to be mindful of that and not to play into the disrespect that comes from not using a person's last name. But at the same time, I think part of the problem politically is that people, particularly positions of power, don't resonate with leaders who look different from them. And so they don't feel the emotional connection and enthusiasm from somebody like a Stacey Abrams the way they do, frankly, with a person like Pete Buttigieg. It's like there's an undercurrent of warmth and connection with, Mayor Pete and, oh, he's this. And people don't feel that with Stacey Abrams. So I wanted to try to convey the warmth and affection and appreciation I have for these people who
are. Is it because she's so cerebral, or is it the misogynoir, or what are you kind of getting at in terms of the name piece of that?
Well, it's not so much for her, I think, just about it's more about the underlying issue around who do they resonate with.
I see.
And I know this because I took Stacey around to meet with lots of major donors and very wealthy people. And then some of these same people, you could see it in their eyes. Their eyes would like you know, when they start talking about Buttigieg, they would like light up. I'm like, oh, he's so smart and I really respect him. Whereas it was nice to be all like, oh yeah, she's good. I like her, you know? And so it's like, there was not the same. And I think that that level of disconnect often will play itself out in the how you refer to somebody.
And since you know her, you wanted to speak with her and have that relationship show through the way you're writing.
Yes, so I want them to feel as warmly towards her as I do.
Got it. So that made a lot of sense to me. The other other decision you talked about is using an uppercase B for the word black people and a lowercase w for the words white people. It seems normal to me, but I guess that's not the current practice everywhere, yeah?
Yeah, well, on two levels. And I wrote about this also in my first book. I also had a little bit. I mean, it's funny how it's not institutionally clear that there's actually a very good essay in the New York Times, maybe a decade ago, about the case for black with an uppercase B. And because you capitalize African American. Mm. And so if you're using black to refer to the same grouping of people, why would that be lowercase? Right. And so, but there is a practice of it being lowercase. And so I actually had some discussion with my publisher originally around this back then. And I was like, if I can't use uppercase B, I'm not going to use the word black in the whole book. I'm going to use African American. So we'll be never able to work that whole piece forward. So there's that piece. And I don't even think it's a standard thing in journalism yet in terms of the standard guides or whatnot. They don't have uppercase B, which is actually nonsensical to me, because why would you under uppercase African-American? So that's that part. And then the white part, I actually changed between my two books. So the first book, I capitalized the W in white. And I wrote about that in the author's note there as well. And then frankly, it was because I didn't want to get into it. And so people will be upset or whatever. But it was a iffy proposition at that point. But I went ahead and capitalized it there. Mm-hmm. I feel like in the intervening several years that the rise of white supremacy and white nationalism in this country is so pronounced. And this notion that white people are preeminent. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to lend any additional support for that worldview. So
yeah,
that's
I mean, I think it's now is the time, if there ever was one, to finally interrogate the notion of whiteness.
Yeah.
You know, I always, when I have to check the boxes, I always have to like, I've got to choose white. And they say, well, are you Hispanic white? They're asking these different questions. And it's like, but I'm Jewish white. You know, I don't want to be associated with this idea of whiteness, even if but I want to mark it because I benefit from white privilege, but I want to interrogate this idea that it even is a classification. So, one thing though that you didn't note, and I noticed it is, you decided to use the N-word spelled out in the book. And that is somewhat of a common practice, I think, but you didn't make a note of that. And I wonder if that was an oversight or if you deliberately decided not to even get into that.
Well, I'm not sure how much it came up as a thought about whether I should. I mean, I'm interested to talk about the thing about humor, and I did try to intersperse that in there. But you know what it is that there is so much denial in this country about the history of racism and white supremacy. And it's the default is to excuse away and deny and refuse to face the facts. And so I wanted to put as much fact and real history in people's faces in a kind of unrelenting way to force them to face the facts and not be able to deny it.
Yeah.
And so in that context, using the N-word fully spelled out I wanted to have people grapple with that and confront it and see the ugliness of what we've had to deal with in this country.
I think it's powerful in that way. And I think you can, for a number of obvious and less so obvious reasons, I think it works. So before I turn to the subject matter, I feel like I'm falling in for a little bit what you mentioned, the comedian Dick Gregory at the end of the notes, and I just want to read this in your words. The civil rights movement got so hung up. Well, you described what Dick Gregory was saying, that the civil rights movement got so hung up on Black that it never got around to power, which I thought was, again, funny, but no. I mean, you know, these things about words matter. All of this matters, and it's important. So moving to this book, the title kind of is one of the best titles for predicting what it's going to talk about, how we win the Civil War. But the central problem that you identify in this book is that again and again, too many Americans choose whiteness over democracy. And this is not just Republicans. It's the way in which the Democratic establishment and political consultants fail to recognize what you call the or fail to discuss the dangerous anti-democratic drift. And one example you give is how Terry McAuliffe got slaughtered in the Virginia governor's race. So in your book, I mean, you do set out this sort of historical pattern of choosing whiteness over democracy, the most recent one being the post-2020 election coup. And you go through more of these, but in terms of the structure of the book, right, you've got part one where you talk about how the Civil War never ended. You have part two where you talk about how we win. And then finally in the epilogue, you provide this glimpse of the society we might want, that we might be able to achieve if we win the war. So why do you say, I mean, this is sort of the whole thesis of your book, but you talk about not, there's two different concepts. There's one that the Civil War never ended. That's a that's an argument. And separately, but that's not the title. That's not what part one is. It's how it never ended. You're like, you know, not even going to try to make the argument. And there are some people who would say, oh, no, it ended.
Right.
So do you want to talk about the first part of the book, how it never, you know, what you mean by it never ended, and what kind of tactics that this sort of Confederates and their ideological descendants have used to keep this Civil War alive?
Yeah, no, it's funny, because originally I was going to call the book Once We Win the Civil War. And it was going to be more of a policy vision and, you know, looking forward. But it took so long to make the case that it had to be really laying out the... And I did actually... I mean, I had the broad strokes understanding the thesis and the premise, but the more I researched and got into it, the more affirmed I was that this was, in fact, very much the case. And so, and I thought again back to this denial issue that I had to be very forceful and relentless to really drive home this point, because it is not conventional wisdom and it's not comfortable, this notion that the Civil War did. And it's what's fascinating to me is the reverence we have for Abraham Lincoln. And that, you know, even one of the, whatever, current or recent bestseller, another book about Lincoln, et cetera.
Everybody loves him, right?
Yes,
all parties. Without
he's held
him.
Up as an example of success and leadership.
Yeah.
And this is what we should all be doing without anybody appreciating the fact that he was murdered by a white supremacist for ending the Civil War. And so that's not part of our national dialogue.
Oh, Steve, details.
Yes. So.
No, that's really... I'm laughing at it, but like, yeah, right?
Right. And I didn't know all those different details. That
yeah.
The Friday after the Sunday surrender in the Civil War, and that Lincoln gave a speech during that week. We're talking 5 days of supposedly surrender. He gives a speech. He mentions something mild about Black people voting. And John Wilkes Booth says, that means N-word citizenship. That's the last speech he'll ever give. And then proceeds to shoot him in the back of the head. That's not surrendering. That's not ending the Civil War.
No.
So that's the, you know, the jumping off point. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, looking at the—
Can we just pause for a moment?
Sure.
And like, why isn't that the way the story is told?
I think it's uncomfortable. We want more of a feel-good story and
But how is it told? Like when we say, he's watching this play and he gets shot by Booth. What do most people think the motivation was? Like, it's kind of like, well,
I don't know. And actually, now that even we're saying this, now I'm
thinking,
actually after we get off, I'm gonna rent that Spielberg movie and see how he actually treats
it. I don't even remember.
We don't get to his assassination. What we talk about it as. Lincoln freed the slaves and ended the Civil War and brought the country together.
Yes.
That's the narrative that people are comfortable with and that people like. Mm-hmm. And broad strokes, that is true, although he did task somebody with running the numbers on how much it would cost to send all Black people back to Africa, because that was a solution that was on the table as well.
Yeah.
But broad strokes, yes, that's true. But if you don't understand what happened and why, it makes it harder to appreciate the moment that we're in. One thing I didn't know at all until researching this was that they put up these statues and memorials to Robert E. Lee and the Confederate soldiers, the Confederate leaders, decades before we put up the Lincoln Memorial. And they resisted putting up the Lincoln Memorial.
Wait, really? Because I'm thinking of most of the statues. I keep thinking about the ones that were put up during Jim Crow as opposed to the earlier ones. Okay.
No. Late 1800s, early 1900s, a lot of these statues went up, particularly the huge-ass one that just came down in Richmond of Robert E. Lee. That was four stories high or whatever. It had been up there, well over 100 years. And they specifically and repeatedly blocked the creation of the Lincoln Memorial, which didn't get created until the 1920s.
So that's like one of my favorite places on the planet. My parents took me there when I was very young, and so I have a memory of feeling like the smallest person in this gigantic Lincoln. Mm. Whenever I go there, I didn't realize what a struggle that was to get it made. I did not know.
Well, that's I think the fundamental point about the. What I talk about in part one of the book is that there has been this consistent, what I call Confederate battle plan. And the first element of it is never giving an inch. And in every single possible way of holding the line that this is fundamentally a country for white people, they have never given an inch. And that's just one of many examples.
Let's go through. So you may not know them off the top of your head. I mean, I know you wrote the book, but sometimes. So the first of these, the strategy to keep that Civil War alive, the first one you said is never give an inch.
Never give an inch. And that the one of the clearest examples of that was the post-Civil War constitutional amendments. Mm. And then most clearly was the 13th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And again, you don't know these things until you actually fully research the book. The 13th Amendment, which simply outlawed slavery, did not have enough votes to pass the House of Representatives. And it had to do multiple votes and amendments. And it was a House of Representatives that had no Southerners in it because they had all seceded. And they still couldn't pass the 13th Amendment originally. Mm. And so that's an example of, they never giving. And then the 14th and the 15th. I mean, President Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, opposed the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment in terms of equal rights and voting rights. So that's the first piece, is never giving an inch. Ruthlessly rewrite the rules and the laws is another part. And so you see that after they passed those amendments, or they passed the 14th Amendment, then you had all of these, that's why you get to the Supreme Court decisions, Plessy versus Ferguson. It's like, yes, there's this amendment, but it doesn't apply here. You can have separate but equal. So rewriting the rules up to including, we used to have whites-only primaries in different parts of the South in the 1920s and 1930s. And the Supreme Court, they kept going back and forth, like 8 different cases, saying that the argument was, well, the political parties are private entities. They're not government entities. So they can have, they're not governed by the Constitution. So they can have, and so as long as the general election is open. But in the South, where there were no Republicans at that time, that didn't make any sense. So ruthlessly rewrite the rules.
But how does that, and that second thing, how does it come to, because your argument is that it's still, the Civil War never ended. So I would say, you know, that those rules are still being rewritten as a Supreme Court, right? They roll back voting rights and so on. Yeah.
In after Obama got elected in 2008, there were dozens of states that passed laws restricting people being able to vote, rewriting the rules, making it harder to vote, voter ID laws, et cetera. After Biden won, dozens of states again in 2021
right,
passed more laws,
voting,
making it harder to vote. So it's been relentless and unceasing, and actually fairly obvious when you have to think about it. I mean, after the Civil War, South Carolina and I believe it was Mississippi were majority Black populations. And so they had to stop people from voting in terms of being able to hold on to their power. So that's the second part. Distorting public opinion is the third part of the Confederate battle plan. So this whole lost cause concept where they redefined what the Civil War was all about. And the most
Hide that it was really, to whitewash, you said, the white supremacy.
Exactly. The most enduring example of that is Gone with the Wind. Which is still, there was a survey in like 2018 or something, it's still like the fourth most popular book in this country. And it basically turns white nationalist slaveholding mass murderers into dashing leading men and, you know, beautiful leading women in this romanticized fashion. And so they completely distorted public opinion around that.
What year was that? Do you remember what year that was
1930s.
Wow. God. Anyhow, I mean, just think about participating in that.
Well, I mean, it was very clear that, you know, the author has been was a fan of the person who did Birth of the Nation, which its first title was The Klansman.
And it was shown at the White House, right? Wasn't it premiered at the White House?
Yes. And it was an explicit response to Uncle Tom's Cabin. They didn't want any sympathy
Stowe's
towards
book,
the.
Yeah.
So that's an example of the distorting public opinion going all the way through.
Yeah.
And then the other two elements of the Confederate battle plan are silently sanctioned terrorism. And so the rise of the Ku Klux Klan began right after the Civil War, 6 months after the Civil War, former Confederate officers, and all very explicitly designed to stop Black people from voting through terrorism. And then there's all looking the other way, sanctioning it. Both presidential parties in 1924 did not have the votes at their conventions to condemn the Klan. Resolutions were brought forward and they could not pass resolutions condemning the Klan because they were that powerful at that point in time. And then the last element—
That was 1924, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The last element, the battle plan, is the playing the long game. And so I think one of the strongest examples of that was the Hayes-Tilden Compromise. So at the end of Reconstruction, again, you had a contested election, and people were fighting at the, you know, election canvas boards at the local level, and people were fighting over the White House. But Senator Gordon from Georgia could see the long game. This is 1877. And he says, we'll surrender the White House. You can have that. Give us back the South. Pull the troops out of the South. Let the slave owners take control again of the states in the South. That's the deal they struck. And that returned the South to control the slave owners and their descendants for 100 years.
Mm.
Now, the hopeful end of that story is that that Senate seat that was Georgia's John Gordon's seat is currently held by Raphael Warnock, the descendant of Martin Luther King.
Who just squeaked by.
Who just squeaked by, but did squeak by. Yeah. So both of those things are in the mix.
And what are you, okay, so it doesn't take much to convince me because this is my worldview, but what are you, for anyone who you could imagine or you have heard in the discourse saying, no, there still isn't a civil war. What are the typical, not convincing, but what are the most prevalent pieces of evidence or arguments that people will make saying, no, not only what they try to say, but why for people who say, no, it's not still a civil war, it's not still going, Why do you think they're invested in not seeing it? And what are the arguments they make if you know?
Well, I mean, I think the clearest example, a manifestation of this, is the whole January 6th situation and debate and where are we going with all that, which is kind of the irony of this whole situation. So the publisher of the New Press approached me in April of 2020 around writing another book. And mm-hmm. I floated the idea around, what if we use the Civil War as a metaphor mm-hmm. for the current moment that we're in? 8 months later, people carrying the Confederate flag, wearing sweatshirts saying MAGA Civil War, January 6, 2021, stormed the United States Capitol and tried to hang the vice president and tried to stop the peaceful transfer of power. So that's not ancient history. That's not a long time ago the Civil War happened. And so that's the clearest example. The majority of the congressional Republicans
yes.
voted to overthrow the elected government of the United States of America.
Right.
And we
after the
people had stormed the Capitol, and they still voted to throw out the votes of the American people that elected Joe Biden and that were certified by every governor, Republican and Democrat.
Right.
So that's a clear repudiation of democracy and an unapologetic repudiation of democracy. And continuing unapologetic to this day for many of these people, up until the former president tweeting out, was it last month, we should suspend the United States Constitution? And so this whole concept that this was a long time ago, unless last month was a long time ago. So it gets to the thing about denial. I think it's difficult for people to live in a sustained state of intensity and urgency and conflict. And people want mm-hmm. it to be over. They want to be able to just, not have to have, this level of conflict. But it's here. And so
Can I be the devil's advocate? Not because mm-hmm. I'm them, but all of these we can tick off and dispense of. You'll hear, it's only a few bad apples. And I can see the vote, though. Right.
I mean, the majority of the elected members of Congress, Republican Party, that's a lot of bad apples in terms of
right.
a few.
Okay, let me do the next one. There's good people on both sides.
Well, that's what Trump famously said at the white supremacist march in 2017 in Charlottesville.
Well, they want to have the good people on both sides, but then he wants to claim the insurrectionists weren't there. Weren't his people, right? He needs to say they're, anti-fascists.
Point, too, because you had mentioned about Martin Luther King, and it does go back to what he had lifted up around the white moderates. We're not going to have to repent, not just for the actions of the bad people, but for the silence of the good people.
Yes.
And so how is it that after all of what Trump had done, all of the COVID deaths and his irresponsibility attached to it, all of the unrestrained, white nationalism and sexism, he got 10 million more votes in 2020 than he got in 2016. So how do you square that with it's just a few people or the level of tolerance for this it's kind of breathtaking.
What we're often thrown, though, right, is as if these can be decoupled from racism too, before it was like economic anxiety, even though it was extremely wealthy white people who voted for Trump, my favorite is, they just care more about tax cuts. It's like, so you're willing to, first of all, that's really what's going on. You're willing to elect a white supremacist, racist, sexist criminal, and you still don't think it makes you an enabler of all the things that he stands for? I mean, how is it that even if you're going to say it's because you don't want to pay more in taxes, let's unpack why you don't want to pay more in taxes. Where do the tax dollars go?
Exactly.
Who don't you want to support in the society? I mean,
right.
All
we've
of it,
seen
right?
that in California, that the decline of support for public institutions
yes.
parallels the increase in the number of people of color in the population.
Right.
If it's other people, those people, you don't want to pay to support them.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, I can't think. Here's one last thing. Okay. So some people will say, well, yes, those majority of Republicans in the House did oppose the you know, certifying the election of Biden and Harris. However, in the past, in 2017, there were those five people who did the same thing with Trump. I mean, I have a response, but what's your response to that? I mean, first of all, there wasn't an insurrection, but second of all, those were a handful of symbolic votes. Plus, their concern in 2017, certifying Trump, was that we just had that report about, we just found out about the Steele report had just, dossier had come out. We had just found about Mike Flynn, about Trump and Russia, all this stuff. So there were some questions, but it wasn't the majority. No one was doing that in a way that would have actually threatened, I think, the transition of power. Plus, with the Trump situation, unlike with Obama, Obama had conceded. He was not challenging the election. In this case, they were actually standing with him
right. And
challenging the election. And then after the insurrection, I'm sorry, I could go on and on right. And on about this,
but I just want to say
that, you know, so there are people who are heavily invested in ignoring this, but for those of us who get it, who understand, and we look at the map, we look at these elements, the five things you're talking about, not giving an inch, rewriting the laws to preserve white power, distorting public opinion, sanctioning terrorism silently and playing the long game. We see this happen. And so we're still living out the Civil War. We see people, insurrectionists, literally marching through the Capitol with a Confederate flag and on and on. So we know this. So if the war's still going on and we didn't win, just like Lincoln didn't end it, it's still going on, how do we win? What's the answer?
And so that's the second part of the book. And that was like one of my, actually, when people, friends had asked me, she was Andrea Guerrero, who's featured in the book, what I was most excited about with it. And I paused and I thought about it. And I was like, for all of my life, and you know, probably most, certainly people of color who are involved in politics, we've been told by really, frankly, the, you know, white mainstream political leaders, well, yeah, that people of color stuff is nice, but we have to win. So we have to put that on the back burner. And so I was like looking around.
Can I just ask you, Andrea Guerrero, is she the director of Alliance San Diego?
Yes, San Diego.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. Continue. I'm sorry. So they said put that on the back burner. Okay.
And that's historically been what our politics has been. I mean, I came of age in the 80s and the Rainbow Coalition days and the whole thing about super primaries the Democrats set up in the mid-80s.
Rainbow Coalition, Jackson.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I remember. We're the same age. I bet we're probably born the same year.
So that, the party has always been trying to downplay special interest, et cetera, and distance themselves from issues mm-hmm. of racial justice and people of color. And that's been my entire adult life's experience.
And what they're thinking is, don't mention that, don't do it, because why? Strategically, they are mistaken, but what is their thinking?
It'll alienate white people, we'll lose votes from whites, and we'll lose the election.
And we never get more votes from whites anyway.
And so if we want to win, we have to downplay those issues. And it's always been premised on we need to win.
Yeah.
And then I looked around, I was like, wait a minute, we're winning.
Yeah.
We have won in Georgia. We've won in Arizona. They've won 9 out of 10 statewide elections in Virginia. They flipped the entire local government in San Diego County and in Harris County in Texas. Though that's winning.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to tell the story of how we win and to really document and put it back in people's faces, frankly. Yeah, let's talk about what we need to do to win. And let's learn the lessons from the places where we have, in fact, actually won. And mm-hmm. that's what the second half of the book is about, lifting up the examples and lessons from those places that are, you know, former Confederate bastions, in the case of Virginia, the actual capital of the Confederacy, and have now been transformed into much more multiracial, democratic cities, counties, and states.
I love your commitment to investing in people, the real people who are visionary, who are doing the work. And, you know, I'm not surprised that would be part of your formula here. I shouldn't call it a formula, part of your recommendations here, because I see that in the way you write, right? How you think about people. I also, you know, given your admiration for and friendship with Stacey Abrams, I'm not surprised that you're talking about identifying and mobilizing underrepresented voters of color. It's like, to me, this, you know, as much as those of us who agree with what you're saying have always said, you know, Black women are the base of the Democratic Party, why are you trying to win a few more, you know, a few more white voters? Look at where they have been voting. Why don't we just turn out the vote more? Why don't we engage with people more, get people, you know, interested, committed? And how you do that isn't just a week before the election. I mean, this is, you know, part of the long game, part of it. What is that long game? I mean, what does that look like to maintain a voting base and to go up against an entire system, though, that's kind of rigged against us, whether it's the Electoral College that interferes with the ability to have the popular vote work, whether it's the, you know, gerrymandering, the efforts we talked about, you know, trying to make it harder to vote and so on. What is the long game then in light of these obstacles?
And so that's what is the, I try to lift up in the second part of the book, is the common elements in all of these places that have had these successes and have had these victories. And so it's what we term the liberation battle plan, in contrast with the Confederate battle plan. And so it involves investing in leadership, mm-hmm. dedicated, determined, disciplined, self-sacrificing leaders, which I call level five leaders, strong civic engagement organizations. Stacey Abrams told me 10 years ago, he says, there's 1.5 million non-voting people of color in Georgia. I'm going to go register them to vote. And that is the work.
I'm just laughing because, you know, she did it, but oh my gosh, what a vision.
Yes, and that's the work that flipped Georgia for Biden, that flipped it for Warnock, that brought, you know, her certainly closer in 2018. Detailed data-driven plans.
Yes.
And so really having a strong analysis of where the votes are, where the potential is, concentrating your time, energy, and effort in increasing voter turnout in those particular areas, and then playing the long game. All of those places that I mentioned that I feature in the book have 10 uninterrupted years of the same leadership doing this work, mm-hmm. steadily expanding the electorate, and really bringing in more and more activists and organizations and more voters of color, and that then translating to the outcome in the elections. And Arizona is one of the clearest examples of that. There's this really this young activists who were radicalized by the attempt to basically deport their parents, created civic engagement groups, registered hundreds of thousands of people to vote over the past decade. And that was the foundation that led the Democrats to win the Senate and the governorship in Arizona.
Right now, where's the best place if you wanted to if you want to get on the field in the long game? Are there certain organizations you think are good to start with?
Yeah, so I feature these groups in the book. I think for 2023, I have to pause, what year are we in? 2023, that one of the main battles is going to be in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so they're one of the few states that have an election in
off year.
And so we're very poised to take back, the Democrats are poised to take back the state legislature, the House of Delegates, the lower house that we lost 2 years ago. And so the organization, New Virginia Majorities, run by Tram Nguyen, I feature her in the book as well. Mm-hmm. And they're really a model for how to do this work, as well as it's one of the best, I think it'll be one of the best examples and signals around the heading into 2024. So I really would encourage people to look at, learn from, and invest in the work in Virginia in general and New Virginia Majority in particular.
If I'm keeping my eye on the prize and I want to take a peek at the society that would be possible when we win, what does it look like? Is it all rainbows and unicorns? I mean, maybe you don't like rainbows and unicorns, but...
Well, I mean, it's interesting that interesting is not a strong enough word, but the reality of writing this book during a pandemic and then thinking about the kind of society that we want to have and the society that we could have. And so what the response to the pandemic showed is how narrow our thinking had been around mm-hmm. what we could actually do in our society. Actually, one of the first pandemic relief bills went through, like $1 trillion, a couple trillion dollars, it went through very quickly. Somebody tweeted out, oh, so we could afford reparations, right? In terms of what the what we could actually do as a society. And so I used the example around, you know, universal basic income and the different experiments in these different cities. And they're, you know, they're not controversial, but they're not universally loved.
Right.
But then we provided checks to everybody through the COVID relief. Right, we suspended the debt payments or the rental payments.
Yeah,
and so and then you go more broadly than that. Clearly, we don't all need to get into cars and commute to big buildings downtown in order for our society to function or for the economy to function because it continued to function even under the pandemic.
Right.
So those and then that. What does that mean for the environment? And not have to have everybody driving so much. And so my main thing is to expand our imagination. Yeah. In terms of what is possible, and the pandemic has showed us, is that we can actually rethink a lot of the fundamental assumptions about the social contract and what our real goals are for how we want to live and how we want to respect and protect and elevate the people in our society.
I just love that so much. As we finish up, is there anything I didn't ask you about that you want to talk about?
Well, we somewhat touched on, but I think I want to emphasize this point about our perception of leadership. And I referenced, I drew a lot of inspiration from Isabel Wilkerson's book, Cast. Mm-hmm. And she talks in there about how we're all actors on a stage that was built long before we arrived. Mm-hmm. And so, and the roles are predetermined in terms of who gets to be center stage, who is the sidekick, who is less important. And so if you think about it, we've had 46 presidents in this country, all men, 45 white men. So in our minds, the role of president is reserved for a white man. And, but if you look at the places where we have actually won, and something that hasn't gotten enough attention, part of the transcendent and powerful appeal of Stacey Abrams is that she does not look like that model. Mm-hmm. It's also part of the challenge that she has faced, but everybody who is not the thin, straight, white male model looks to Stacey and can resonate and to see a leader like that unapologetically being who she is. But the fundamental point is that the people who have been the best fighters have been those who are from the communities that are most marginalized and are bearing the brunt of the attacks in our society. So we have to rethink our conception of what a leader looks like.
Yes.
And that's a critical thing, which I don't think is widespread enough, even within the progressive movement and progressive politics.
I really wish we could do that. I've always thought about different concepts of power. When I was younger, I really liked the idea of wanting power among instead of power over. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think others have said, you know, is it Gloria Steinem who years ago said we're not ranked, we're linked. I mean, mm-hmm. this is all idealistic, but, you know, or you look at someone like I've been thinking recently about Volodymyr Zelensky, who stayed in Ukraine, you know, on the street and said, I'm here, a very different notion. And I think if we, you know, I think we should be evolving toward a recognition that power is a web in a network.
Maybe to tie it all back to where we began, as I haven't really ever talked about this publicly, but Susan's main doctors were women. Mm. And her neuro-oncologist, Jennifer Clark. And it was striking how different her approach was and how collaborative and how much about being linked and that not full of like ego and bravado. And I really believe that that approach of working together and having a different approach to what leadership and power and activity is like brought her the kind of support that enabled us to survive 6 years and 3 months for a disease that had a median survival of 18 months. And I really believe it was the approach of her team of female doctors that brought her that superior level of care.
That is a beautiful story. How do How do people find you besides finding your book, How We Win the Civil War, Steve?
So probably best to go to democracyincolor.com. So this is the organization. We have our podcast there, but people can sign up for our newsletter, democracyincolor.com. We do a weekly newsletter.
I just did today.
Oh, okay, great. And so we put out, you know, featured key things in the news, some analysis, different highlights of stuff. So that's probably the best way to stay in touch with us is to sign up for that newsletter at democracyincolor.com.
Well, thank you. And thanks so much for spending this time with me today.
Thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate it.
That was an amazing conversation. I think Steve's love and commitment to his wife shines through everything he does today. And I know that her memory will be a blessing. I was especially interested in his suggestions about how we can all get involved right now in 2023, testing out the strategy for winning the Civil War. And that includes getting involved in the governor's election and the state legislative election in Virginia. I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. You can send me an email at bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write to bookedup at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, please follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really helps other people find the podcast.